Hello and welcome to the Heathrow results for the half year to 30th of June 2023. Throughout the call, all participants will be in a listen-only mode, and afterwards there will be a question and answer session. Please note, this call is being recorded. Today I'm pleased to present John Holland-Kaye. Please begin your meeting.
Thank you. Well, hello and welcome to all of those in the room and all those who are joining us on the conference call. So thank you for joining our 2023 half-year results. I'm John Holland-Kaye, Chief Exec at Heathrow Airport, and with me is Javier Echave, Chief Financial Officer, and Sally Ding, our Director of Treasury and Business Planning. And today we'll present our key operational and strategic highlights and a review of our financial performance and outlook, and Javier will take us through those, and then I'll conclude by taking any questions. And last time we were together, I said my ambition was that we would make Heathrow boring again. And judging by the lack of movement in our credit spread today, and I think we only had two questions from analysts this morning, my job here is done. And this will actually be my last results presentation, so I'll have a little reflection at the end, if you will indulge me, on just how far we have come over the last few years. But let me start by giving you an overview of our operational and financial highlights on slide four. And I'm delighted to say a very strong first half of the year, with 37.1 million passengers travelling through Heathrow. Our operation has performed well over the first half, which included some of the busiest days on record. And it was the detailed planning and close collaboration across all of our Team Heathrow partners that have been key to our success. And I'm really pleased that the summer getaway has got off to a very good start. We just had the peak weekend last weekend. It went very, very smoothly. Part of what we've been working on over the last few months is rebuilding our resilience so that we can cope with bad things that happen, which, as you know, in aviation is not uncommon. And one of the things that I've taken a lot of comfort from is the fact that we had 18 days of strike action, including Terminal 5 security being on strike, and no one missed their flight. No one was delayed. That's a really good sign that Heathrow is getting back to health. And I think all of our colleagues from Heathrow here in the room today would have put on their purple polo shirt and gone to help out in security in that time. And that gives you a sense for how we all pull together to serve our passengers. I'm glad that we've now agreed a fair pay deal with our frontline colleagues, and that removes the threat of strike action this year and next year. From a financial perspective, our performance continues to recover. Revenue grew to £1.7 billion and operating costs to £672 million, leaving an EBITDA of £1.1 billion. However, we do continue to make an adjusted loss before tax when asset and financing costs are taken into account. Our balance sheet remains strong, with gearing below pre-pandemic levels and £3.7 billion of group liquidity. Finally, you'll have seen that the board confirmed Thomas Wolby, who's currently the chief executive at Copenhagen Airport, a fantastic airport, will be joining as my successor in October. So I'll remain in place through the summer and have a smooth handover to Thomas during October. So let's turn to slide five for a view of our strategic priorities. I've touched on the first one, which was about rebuilding the ecosystem, getting people back, making sure they've got the skills and experience to do their jobs well. One of the things we've learned over COVID is that the ecosystem at Heathrow is way too complicated. There are too many people trying to do the same things in different ways. So part of our agenda is to simplify that, standardize and automate as much as we can, and get closer, but not as far as the much simpler model you see in some of the Middle Eastern hubs that we compete with. From a regulatory point of view, the CMA granted our permission to appeal and the airline's permission to appeal in May. The hearings have now taken place, so the CMA are considering those grounds, and we should have a final decision before the 17th of October. We believe the settlement should be incentivizing investment to rebuild service rather than just focusing on cost-cutting measures that do little to benefit customers. In terms of sustainability, we're making really good plans on progress on our plans for net zero carbon aviation. I've been really pleased to see that a lot of other airports are copying or following our lead on the incentive for using sustainable aviation fuel. That is going to help to stimulate the supply of sustainable aviation fuel. And I'm hoping that the same will happen with the sustainability-linked bond that we launched recently, which covers 100% of carbon emissions, including emissions in the air, which is the first time that that has happened, and great credit to the team. So I'll let Javier talk about that, and I know some of you were involved in that. And finally, we remain committed to expansion, but I'm leaving it to Thomas to lay out his plans for that after he arrives in October. So let me just move on slide seven to touch a little bit on what's happening behind the scenes with demand. And the first thing is 37 million passengers is more than we were expecting to have in the first half of the year. We've built up our capacity so that we were able to cope with any level of demand coming through. It's a big increase on what we saw this time last year, still about 4% below where we were in 2019. And what we're seeing is that leisure demand is still very buoyant. It's 3% above where it was in 2019, which is sort of defying all kind of gravity. You would think that with cost of living crisis, the high price of airline tickets, some of the global economic slowdown, we'd be seeing leisure travel coming down. And you might remember I was expecting that to start to tail off at the end of last year, but it's still going. So we do still expect that gravity to start to take effect sometime over the next 6 to 12 months. And I think some of the airlines have been talking about that publicly as well. But we want to make hay while the sun is shining. Business travel is still quite some way behind where it was in 2019, about almost 20% down on 2019 levels. We are seeing it coming back. It's grown by over 50% in the last 12 months. And I think speaking to some of you earlier, the feedback I'm getting is that people are getting back to traveling as normal and realizing that managing your work life by teams is not very satisfying. And for some of us, brings back a bit of PTSD from lockdown periods. But business travel is coming back. It's just a little bit slower. And it'll be interesting to see what happens in September, which traditionally is when leisure travel tails off and business travel takes over. By market, we've seen strong performance in North and Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East. The benefits of trade and tourism links with these markets is hugely important for the UK, and we're proud of the role we play as the gateway to the world. Asia Pacific is still 20% down, and most of this is about the slow opening up of China. So we'd expect to see some of that starting to recover, and maybe some of that sort of post-pandemic wave of leisure travel coming out of China taking over from some of the decline from other markets. Cargo is quite interesting. Unsurprisingly, the cargo-only traffic movements are coming back to the level they were before the pandemic. Cargo volume overall, though, and a lot of this is carried in belly hold, is still about 20% down on where it was pre-pandemic. Now, what's happening here is two things. One is that with the global economic slowdown, that's starting to be felt in the air cargo market, and you'll see that in certainly all the European airports. But we're seeing this sort of Brexit effect where historically a lot of cargo came through the tunnel on cargo lorries and were loaded onto planes to Heathrow because of the connectivity that we had. And some of that is now diverting through other European hubs. So that's just a Brexit effect that is starting to affect us. So slide eight, we're just taking a look at how we compare with other European airports. And this is our sort of core hub competitor set that we think of Charles de Gaulle, Schiphol, Madrid, and Frankfurt. And what you'll see here is that Heathrow has recovered more quickly than the other major hub competitors. And we're still 17% ahead of Charles de Gaulle. And if you remember, before the pandemic, Charles de Gaulle was starting to edge up towards us. Amsterdam were not far behind Charles de Gaulle, but they've taken much longer to recover. And that is a really good, for those of you on the credit side, that's a really good sign of the robust demand that we have at Heathrow compared to many of our other hub competitors. Madrid actually is doing pretty well. The Spanish market was much less affected by COVID and didn't have the reduction in workforce there that most of the other European airports and we did for other reasons. Well, hub connectivity has improved. We now have 225 destinations. We're back to being one of the best connected airports in the world and one of the few to have over 100 long-haul routes. And that's a real advantage that even most other hubs don't benefit from. One thing I'm really pleased about was that last year we took a look at our domestic charging and how we could start to encourage more domestic routes to be developed. And we reduced the minimum charge for domestic routes, and that's led to quite a big increase in domestic routes. So Loganair has opened up, I think, three or four new routes, and we're now up to 12 domestic markets. That's a really important bit of connectivity for UK regions connecting through Heathrow to get to global markets. And what we're encouraging the government to do is to, in perpetuity, have slots going into Heathrow from each of the UK regions, morning and evening, to make sure that those regional economies can always be guaranteed access to global markets through Heathrow. And that, I think, is a key policy to helping to support a fair and balanced economic recovery. So slide nine, I thought I'd add something in which sort of gave a sense for how we see our competition. And we're used to talking a lot about the USA. It's our most important trading market for the UK. It's the only market with whom we have a balance of trade surplus. But the way I think about it is that if you're setting your hub airport up for success in the 21st century, you want to be the best connected airports to all of the big economic markets of the 21st century. And the big growth markets for the next few decades are going to be the US, India, and China. Others are very important, but those are the keys that you want to be connected to. And so we need to be as well connected to India and China as we currently are to the US. And our position on the US is quite remarkable. We have 31 destinations in the US, 248 daily flights back and forth. That's a depth of market and a range of market that is unparalleled anywhere else. So if you want to fly from anywhere in Europe to the US, your best port is to go through Heathrow. And that's a massive competitive advantage. We have a 30% market share, 33% market share of the US market going through Heathrow. That is remarkable when you think about the scale of some of our competitors with Frankfurt, Madrid, Schiphol, and Charles de Gaulle. China, we're actually in a similar position on. We have one in three seats flying between China and Europe go through Heathrow. That again is a competitive advantage at the moment. For India, it's 50% of all seats go through Heathrow. A huge advantage. But these are very small numbers of flights and relatively few cities. The battleground will be about who can be best connected to not just the primary cities in India and China, but the secondary cities as well, in the way that we are going into the US. So that's where the opportunity lies. And that's where expanding Heathrow will allow us to access those markets and win out over competitors like Charles de Gaulle. So that is the great opportunity that we have. Now, let me come back to service standards on slide 10. And you'll remember that this time last year, we were just coming through the summer peak. We just put a cap in place. It was a really difficult time. No one wants to turn away business, but it was a critical thing that we did to protect passengers who were flying through Heathrow. And afterwards, although they didn't say it in public, almost every airline chief exec I spoke to said that was exactly the right thing to do because they were massively under stress last summer. We've worked hard to make sure that we have enough people trained up, good resilience to deliver good service now. And what you can see here on the bottom left-hand side is our monthly security queue times. That's one of the key measures for part of the service that we provide in the passenger journey. And you'll see that we are back to getting passengers through security in 5 minutes or less, which is a fantastic achievement and actually far better than you'd expect in most other airports around the world. So really pleased that all the work we put in is paying off there. And you'll see that in that sort of grey bar, even during the strikes during April and May, we still maintain that high service level thanks to the contingency planning that we have put together. So that part of the business is working really well. If you look at our ASQ, which is our airport service quality scores, you'll see they're still some way behind where they were in 2019. They're better than they were this time last year, but they're still behind where they were in 2019. And what's happening there is that the same number of people are saying we either give a good or very good service, which is either a four or a five in the scaling, but there's a higher proportion who say we're just a good level. And so that's the opportunity. We need to get some of those passengers back into seeing our services being very good. And the key thing that's holding that back is punctuality. We have a far lower arrivals punctuality coming to Heathrow than we had pre-pandemic. And when you've got poor arrivals punctuality, That means that when you get to a stand, there won't be anyone there to meet it, so you might get delayed getting on the stand. There might not be baggage handlers to get your bags off the plane. The whole journey is just clunky and takes a lot of time and has delay, and none of us want to have that kind of a journey. But that's what happens when you have poor punctuality. And if planes arrive late, then they tend to depart late as well. And again, that is a big source of, you know, none of us want to be delayed on our flights going out either. And the same impacts can happen of people being in the wrong place at the wrong time. So we know what needs to, we know why we have low arrivals punctuality. It's congested airspace over Europe. It's lack of air traffic controllers, particularly in Europe, but not only there. Canada has similar kind of issues. And it's weather, which is something that is very top of mind at the moment. But all of those will be addressed over time. What we've been focusing on is making sure that even if planes come in late, we are turning them around as fast as we can. So we've been closing the gap between arrivals and departures punctuality, so that you can see that starting to turn around. So that gives me confidence that the actions we're taking are working. And we've also been building in resilience, so that if we know planes are going to be late, what are we going to do about them? For example, we have recruited a hit squad of baggage handlers who can go and help out the ground handlers who work for the airlines, so that if they're short of staff, we can send our own people in to help out and get bags on and off planes. And that has been incredibly effective over the last few weeks of dealing with the summer peak. So we've got a good plan. We know what we need to do, and it's working. Last time we were together, I talked a bit about next generation security, which is the new security systems that allow you to keep your laptop and liquids in bags. And we are rolling that out. It's a big program. It's going to cost nearly £1 billion to upgrade all of the security lanes at Heathrow. Almost around half of all the security lanes being installed in the UK are happening at Heathrow. And that gives you a sense of the scale of the challenge we have. I just wanted to touch on two other big investment programs today. The first is Terminal 2 baggage. And if you travel through Terminal 2, it's a fantastic terminal, world-class, very easy, simple journeys. We only opened it in 2014, but the baggage system is sitting in the old Terminal 1 building, and it's 40 or 50 years old. And if you go in there, you wouldn't believe how antiquated the baggage system is. So we need to replace it. We have a plan to do that. We'll be putting into the new Terminal 2 building. We've figured out how to do that, and that will be opening in early in H8. So that's going to be a big transformation. It'll improve reliability, efficiency, safety in the baggage area. So that's going to be a big advantage. The second big program I want to touch on is Efficient Airport, and this is a program which is starting to address some of the issues I talked about earlier about the ecosystem being too complicated. How do we start to automate some of the normal passenger flows, having more self-bag drops in all of our terminals, managing the information between ourselves, the airlines, and their handlers, so that people know where they need to be when, and we can identify issues more quickly. So there's a lot of work happening around that. And one of the other parts of this is improving service for passengers who need special support. And you might have seen in the papers a couple of days ago, there was a report from the CAA looking back on last year at our service standards for people with reduced passengers with reduced mobility, where they scored us the worst actually among UK airports as needing improvement. It's not something I'm deeply concerned about, and is really a function of the fact that last year we had a much higher growth in passengers needing support than the overall demand, and we were working frantically to try to scale up our provision. What we've done over the last year is we've doubled the number of people we have working in that area. So we now have 1,200 people. We've been improving the facilities. So in Terminal 3, we've put in much bigger lifts, which allow buggies to pick people up the plane, drive them to the lift, change levels, and then go to arrivals, which makes it a much simpler journey. And that's all part of the Efficient Airport program. And I'm pleased to say that for 2023, we have been at the good level for the CAA's scoring. So the plan we have is working. There's a lot more we need to do there, but we've definitely turned the corner. So finally, before I hand over to Javier on slide 12, let me just touch on our sustainability plans. So we brand our sustainability plan as Heathrow 2.0, which is about net zero aviation and making Heathrow a great place to live and work. We're really pleased to have achieved science-based validation from the SBTi for our 2030 carbon reduction goals, including emissions in the air, and they confirm that our plans are consistent with a 1.5-degree carbon reduction trajectory. That's a real big milestone. People don't think that aviation can get to net zero, but we can, and we're on path to do it. And part of our leadership role here is we want to be able to demonstrate what can be done and then deliver against it to act as a role model for other aviation businesses. But this is what's given us the framework for our funding strategy, and Harry will talk shortly about the sustainability-linked bond that we launched. And that really shows us just how committed we are to sustainability. In terms of sustainable aviation fuels, the incentive we have in place, which is worth nearly 40 million pounds this year, has really led to a massive uptake in sustainable aviation fuels. It'll be about 1.5% of all of our volume of fuel uplifted this year. And that scheme has been oversubscribed. And we're planning to take that up to 11% of all of our demand by 2030, which is in line with our SBTi-linked goal. In terms of creating a great place to live and work, we've consulted with stakeholders to develop our noise action plan. We're aiming to reduce sleep disturbance and annoyance levels by 2030. So we're looking at the outputs of noise rather than just measuring noise itself, because each of us experiences noise in a different way. The actions that we're working on are in further incentivizing quieter planes as new generations of fleet come out, and a revised noise insulation scheme for local residents and caps to restrict nighttime movements. And finally, we have a giving back program where we encourage our colleagues to work more with members of the local community. So far, we've delivered about 1,500 hours of volunteering by colleagues, in spite of everything else we have going on, and 4,000 work experience opportunities for local students. So we're starting to make an impact for our local communities. So let me pause there and hand over to Javier to talk about our financial performance.
Thank you, John, and hello to everyone. Great to see so many people that are choosing the U.K. to listen to us rather than having a rewarding siesta at this time of the day. So let me share with you now an overview of our key financial performance, starting on slide 14. So as John mentioned, during the first half of the year, we saw a strong recovery in passenger numbers, which led to an increase in revenue of approximately 1.7 billion. As we continue to invest in rebuilding capacity, operating costs increased also to 672 million, and as a result, our adjusted EBITDA increased to 1.1 billion pounds. We continue to see higher finance costs, not a surprise, because it's mainly impacted by inflation and interest rates. And the combination of lower charges that John mentioned on the back of the decision from BCA, as well as higher financing costs, explains why we remain loss-making at the pre-tax level once we remove the accounting non-cash adjustments on investment properties and financial instruments. But despite all of that, our losses have been halved over the last year. In terms of balance sheet remains strong, with an increase in cash flow from operations to 887 million pounds. And that has allowed us to increase capital expenditure, with cash spent at 279 million pounds. When looking at net debt, I'm very pleased that it remains broadly flat at the group level, with the cash generated from operations largely covering our capital expenditure, interest paid, but also the increase in accretion as inflation remains high. Finally, our regulatory asset base, critical and regulated business, has increased to nearly 20 billion, obviously driven by capital expenditure, but more importantly, by inflation. Let's now take a closer look at the details, starting with revenue on slide 15. John also alluded that the standard overall revenue increased by 36% to 1.7 billion pounds compared to 2022, driven by higher passenger numbers, but also solid performance in absolute terms across all revenue streams. Although our revenue in nominal terms is up 19% in compared with 2019, when we adjust for inflation, it shows that in real terms, it's still 8% lower than in 2019. Again, mainly driven by lower regulated revenue. We continue to see an impact in our retail revenue due to the removal of duty-free shopping, which is damaging our industry's international competitiveness. To help to mitigate this, we are further developing our commercial proposition as part of our H7 investment plan. To talk about this, let me bring to life some of the elements of our commercial capital program on slide 16. Let me continue with Terminal 2, where John started, to highlight also not only the operational changes in baggage, but also the retail improvements that you can see more as a passenger. We will introduce 13 new openings and refits with fresh brands, including a new premium Starbucks unit to enhance the choice and passenger experience. Also to meet the changing nature of how passengers shop, we are expanding our digital retail platform across the business, providing upfront payment capability and introducing more collection points in Terminal 3 and Terminal 4, especially for click and collect convenience. We are also working to increase the availability of our retailers trading online. The team are also reviewing terminal space, ensuring we adapt to the changing demands and profiles of our passengers and delivering optimal retail offerings, which can also support peak flow and seat availability. Finally, on our VIP offering, hopefully something popular in this group, we are rebranding and refurbishing our suites, providing an increase in private capacity. Moving to slide 17, let's take a closer look at our cost base. We have seen a 25% increase in our operating costs to 672 million pounds as we rebuild capacity. No surprises from what we have said in the previous quarters. Moving to different components, people costs, which include third-party sourcing, have risen to 214 million pounds, mainly due to additional costs associated with recruitment, but also overtime and training to ensure we had the necessary resources and capability in place. Also the rise in operational maintenance cost is primarily due to full operations now being open for the whole year and the impact of obviously high inflation. In terms of utilities and other costs, not a surprise, it has been a significant increase by around 54%, and this is driven by higher consumption because of the full operation, but also high energy prices and inflation. Importantly, and despite all these pressures, you can see at the bottom of the slide that when we compare our costs in real terms, it remains 6% below 2019 levels, which reflects the ongoing efforts that we continue having to optimize efficiency, but also to maintain tight control over operating costs. Moving to slide 18, which shows how we have managed our cash over the past 3 years. Again, no surprises from what we have said before. Our cash burn is normalizing and returning to 2019 levels as we increase our OpEx and also our investment goes back to more normal levels. Also we are catching up on the underinvestment in assets during the pandemic and inflationary pressures. Interest paid, something that also we explained clearly, hopefully during the pandemic, is also increasing as the benefit of the swap reprofiling program that we put in place last year has completely unwound now, and we will see that offsetting increase from this spread across the next regulatory periods. The reprofiling we did over the pandemic will be spread over the next two regulatory periods. We continue to maintain strong liquidity with 3.7 billion pounds of cash and undrawn facilities available to the group, and this has increased subsequently in July to 4.2 billion pounds following the completion and the receipt of the proceeds of the sustainability-linked bond. From here, we expect that this excess liquidity that we have built on the back of the pandemic will gradually decrease, but also as we increase the ramp-up and investment in operation, although we will continue to maintain 24 months of liquidity. Again, no changes. Overall, we are comfortable with our financing position and with around 95% of our debt being fixed and our inflation to RAB exposure at just over 50%, we are well positioned to manage the current market backdrop from a rates and inflation perspective. On slide 19, I would like to talk about our commitment to sustainability through our financing activity. As John has already mentioned, we completed our first sustainability-linked bonds earlier this month. This was the culmination of 2 years of hard work and reinforces our commitment to sustainability by incorporating it into our financing strategy. Today, I'm pleased to say that we have a great framework which allows us to issue across products and markets, and we have carefully selected key performance indicators that address 100% of our carbon footprint, including those from airlines, first airport in the world. This achievement is a first of the broader airport sector, but also underlines our dedication to leading the way in sustainable practices. The transaction was a huge success. Among others, many people in this room helped us addressing and reaching investors across the globe. I would like to thank all the investors, but also banks and partners, for supporting us on this critical transaction and getting behind our new framework. As you know, incorporating sustainability into our funding strategy is not only aligned with our core values, but also is a position and will position us as a leader in driving positive change. Turning to slide 20, you can see that we have continued to prioritize the protection of liquidity and cash flow. Unfortunately, or fortunately, no surprises again in this slide. At the Heathrow S.p., net debt has seen a slight increase to 14.8 billion since year-end. Our net cash flow from operations reached 887 million pounds, reflecting the underlying growth in EBITDA. It's important to note that this growth was offset by CapEx spend, external interest paid, but also increase in accretion on our inflation-linked bonds and swaps. No payments have been made to external shareholders, and we are not forecasting dividends this year. Again, in conclusion, we remain consistent with our approach and messages over the last few months, and we continue and we will continue managing finances prudently and maintaining a robust balance sheet. On slide 21, we can see that our gearing is currently lower than it was before the pandemic. This is due to not only our efforts on managing net debt and the positive impact of inflation on our RAB. Our gearing ratios have decreased since the end of the previous year, and we are very pleased to see that the covenant headroom for all three classes of our capital expenditure remains comfortable. The headroom to gearing trigger events at Class A and Class B remains comfortable at 63.2% and 74.1% respectively, and also gearing at Heathrow Finance at 80% levels. We will continue to protect our financial position, and I'm confident that our strong balance sheet and financial discipline positions us well for the future as we continue to grow. Finalizing my section, turning to slide 22 and to talk about outlook for the year. Our performance outlook remains consistent with the forecast published in our June investor report, with a traffic forecast in the range of 70 million-78 million passengers and adjusted EBITDA of 1.96 billion for the whole year. We will continue to monitor performance, and I will provide an update at our Q3 results in October. With that, I conclude the financial review, and I'll hand it back to John for closing comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Javier. I thought, as this is my last time speaking to you like this, I thought it might be worth sort of looking back on how far we have come, because Heathrow is a very different place to the company that I joined back in 2009. A lot of that transformation has been thanks to the support that the people in this room and on this call have given us. When I joined just at the end of the global financial crisis, Heathrow had an awful reputation. In my first day in the job, I saw that ASQ survey, which showed us being the third worst airport in the world. We were something like 243rd in the world for passenger service. If you were to look at a newspaper around this time of year when people are going on holiday, you'd have a cartoon saying, "I'm just going away for 2 weeks. I hope to get to the front of the queue of security at Heathrow before I have to come home again." That was the kind of reputation that we had, and it was like that every single year. I remember colleagues wouldn't tell people where they worked if you went out for a dinner party because they were too embarrassed about working at Heathrow. It's a surprise to hear that, but that is how things were. They talk about how they worked in transportation in West London, but they wouldn't say they worked at Heathrow because you get a torrent of complaints about the poor journey people had, the delays, the loss of bags, and all that kind of thing. This was not long after Terminal 5 had opened, which you remember was not a huge success, even though Terminal 5 itself is a fantastic achievement. A lot had to change, and many of us in this room have been part of that transformation. You remember when I took over as chief executive, I thought we need to set some ambitious goals for the organization. And I set as a target that we become, we give passengers the best airport service in the world. And that seemed an unlikely goal given where we were coming from. But if you don't aim high, you're never going to get to where you want to get to. And people are motivated by being the best, not by being the second best or being the third best. So that's where we had our goal. But it's a very clear message that we would win by focusing on the consumer, not by focusing just on airlines or on infrastructure or asset management or retail. Which were the things that people tended to focus on. So part of the culture change we had was to become a consumer organization. And the four priorities that I set out, which I have bored you with many times, are really a balanced scorecard. Mojo is about making Heathrow a great place to work. Transforming customer service speaks for itself. Beat the plan is about doing all that while outperforming our regulatory settlement. And sustainable growth is about achieving organic growth and expansion, but doing it in a way which is consistent with net zero. And we haven't delivered everything that we set out to do, but we have come an awfully long way. And in terms of Mojo, there are a number of things I could point to, but one of them is that we were named by the Sunday Times and by Glassdoor as being one of the best companies to work for in the UK. That's a world away from the Heathrow that I joined. And a lot of that has been because of the talent development that we have, the diversity. One of the first organizations to have equal numbers of men and women in senior management. And actually, almost all the people that you know from the Heathrow team have benefited from internal development and promotion. And it's made us a much better organization. And Heathrow in 2009 would not have had the entire management team cancelling their holidays to go and work in security. But that's what we do now. And it's a really good thing. In terms of transforming passenger service, both T5 and T2 at times have been competing to be the best airport terminal in the world, which, having built Terminal 2, I know which one I am gunning for. But Terminal 5, which is bigger, does tend to win. And that's a good sign. I think we've been in the top 10 worldwide for 8 years, which is a massive achievement given where we were coming from. And I think we're the only privately owned airport in the top 10. And when you think about the resources that many countries will put into their national hub, that is quite an achievement. And we've only been able to do that partly because of the culture change, but also because of the investment you have supported in improving the airport. So you've been a big part of this. In terms of Beat the Plan, Q6, certainly until COVID hit, was the first time we'd ever outperformed our regulatory settlement. And we did it partly by growing passenger numbers, which comes from providing better service and working better with airlines. But we also did it by reducing our costs consistently year after year. And it's not easy to do the two, but actually the more the better the service, the more efficient you have to be to deliver that, the more cost-effective you are as well. So there was a virtuous circle And what I wouldn't like to have on this list, we got through COVID. Again, thanks to the support that you gave us in some really difficult times. And there were times when we had these meetings when our credit spread definitely had moved. And we had far more than two questions from credit analysts. It's been a really difficult few years, and we've had to undo a lot of good things we had done. But as you'll see from the results today, we are back to our best, and we are back to stability. And I'm very happy to have no movement in credit spreads. In terms of sustainable growth, when I joined, that was a time of David Cameron, no ifs, no buts, no third runway. And getting the 4-1 majority in Parliament only 8 years later, for Heathrow expansion is a huge achievement and sets us up for delivering the kind of connectivity I talked about earlier to India and China. There's a long way to go, and I would have liked to have delivered the planning consent before I moved on, but COVID sadly got in the way of that. But we are in a good position. And what I wouldn't have expected would be that at a similar time to that, we were named Sustainable Business of the Year. You don't expect an airport to be a sustainable business, but part of the culture change that we've had has led us to that. And the fact that our CFO can be chairing accounting for sustainability and sustainability-linked bonds shows how this has just become part of what we do. And so that's a really good step forward. And something that both Javier and I have put a lot of time into is getting the industry behind decarbonizing. It's not enough for Heathrow to set net zero goals. We need the global aviation sector to get there. And as we've talked about before, getting the ICAO net zero by 2050 commitment, which means that aviation is not exceptional anymore. We will be doing the same things other sectors are doing. That is a huge change. And it's taking us a lot of work building a coalition of willing among airlines, airports, and also governments to get us there. But that puts us onto a level playing field to decarbonize. So I'm really pleased by how far we have come. I will always want to have done more than we actually achieved, but we're in a really good place. And I'm glad that I'm handing over to Thomas in October with the business in a really good shape, ready to finish off delivering my to-do list. But I'm sure that Thomas will have an even better and more ambitious to-do list than I have. He's a great guy, and I'm sure you will enjoy working with him. So thank you very much. Let me move on to questions, and then we can close in a few minutes. And Annika, I think we're going to start with questions online.
Yes, please. Thank you. If you do wish to ask an audio question, please press star 11 on your telephone keypad. If you wish
Maybe
to withdraw your question,
have a sweepstake on how many questions we will get, and I'm losing.
If you wish to withdraw your question, you may do so by pressing star 11 again to cancel. There will be a brief pause whilst questions are being registered. The first question comes from the line of James Farrow from BNP Paribas. Please go ahead.
Hi, James.
Yeah, hi. Afternoon, everyone. Thanks for the call. And John, thanks for all your kind of help and communication over the years. It's been appreciated by the credit community, even if we don't always ask you lots of questions. Pretty easy ones, actually. First was actually for Sally, just in terms of the kind of funding update is always useful. Obviously, the recent bond issue went well, but yeah, always helpful to know what you're thinking for the second half of the year. Secondly, on the kind of leverage, say nice to see that coming down. Just interested to know how much of that actually would you put down to the inflation effect, sort of rather than cash generation. I mean, I guess small numbers, but say obviously that's helping you in the current environment. And then really the last question is really just for John. So your interesting comments you made about your time here. It's a lot has happened over that period. I guess one, you know, maybe one question for you. What, you know, during your time here, if you just reflecting, what probably would you say has been the biggest surprise or something that you weren't expecting that you wish you'd known when you took up the job? That's it from me. Thanks.
Thank you. Great. Well, you've got two great questions for Sally while I think about the answer to the third one.
Cool. Thanks, James. In relation to the funding plan, we have about 750 million funding put in this year. We have done majority bulk of it, and we have about 100 to 150 million left this year that, as usual, we will have in conversation with the investors and the market to complete the funding program for this year. As you know, we are portfolio funding that we are aimed to and always keen to maintain at least 24 months liquidity horizon, so not refinancing any bond for any particular one. I do have a question also on the chat here on a similar question about the funding plan, Sophie. So hopefully that also addressed your questions here. So that's on the funding plan. So James, what's the second question? Yeah. So in terms of the leverage, obviously, with the inflation, you know, we're in a very good position in terms of leverage. Have you seen the numbers? Obviously, inflation helps the RAB, but also increases the net debt. But that's the hedging strategy we put in place many, many years ago. And it's the company's strategy to make sure the debt to be inflation linked in the same way to hedging our assets, which is also inflation linked. So we should see this continuing in terms of our funding strategy.
So James, I think if I can just add on leverage, probably it's easier to see when you look at the full picture. So if you look at our investor report we published in June, the majority of the increase in the RAB is driven by inflation. So I think at this stage, we have a capital plan in 2023 for 570 million. It's still under our depreciation. So we are depreciating the RAB at around 800 million pounds. So the impact that you are seeing in the RAB is, as you know, the RAB is directly linked to RPI. So year on year, 2023, 2022 to projected 2023, we are forecasting to increase in the region of 4.5%.
Right.
So basically, it's really coming from inflation, is effectively what you're saying.
Primarily, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's clear. Thank you.
Thanks. And James, I've been trying to think of what I like the way you word your question. What would be the biggest surprise? I suppose one of the biggest surprises, which kind of gives you a sense for the kind of culture we have at Heathrow, is when I took over just after the Q6 settlement had been struck. That gave us a challenge, I think, of reducing costs by £600 million. Yeah. And so I said to our strategy director, look, we've got to reduce costs by £600 million, but can we? Do you think we could do £1 billion? If we include revenue increase as well. And she said, yeah, okay, we'll have a go at that. And I thought, oh, that was easy. I was expecting to have a battle over that one. And of course, delivering it was very hard. But one of the joys about being the chief executive is that you can ask people to do outrageous things, and they'll do their damnedest to try to get there. And that's what we've done. So that's one of the reasons we set ourselves such ambitious targets back in 2014. Great. Do you have another question, Annika?
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, please press *11 on your telephone keypad if you would like to ask a question.
So, Annika, perhaps while we're waiting, we'll go to some of the questions that have come in on the chat. So the... First one's from Miguel Medina Civilotti, which is two questions. Were internal candidates considered for the CEO position? Yes, but we also did a global search. And one of the great things about being a well-regarded company is you will attract global talent. And so we're very pleased that Thomas is joining us. Secondly, slightly more technical, adjusted EBITDA conversion into operating cash flow is lower than in the first half of 2022 due to working capital outflow. Can you comment on working capital evolution?
I'll take that one.
Do you want to say that one?
I was going to wait for John to answer that one. This is the reverse outrageous demand. Miguel, I have to say that there's no changes materially. So the number might look slightly big. It's around £87 million. But again, no changes. I think that there has been no changes in pattern in terms of invoicing. So as you know, we invoice our airlines every 14 days. So no changes on that, and that drives 60% of our revenue. We have been for many, many years, including the pandemic, prompt payment code member of the prompt payment code. So we continue operating the majority of our suppliers within 30 days, and therefore no changes in that. I think in this particular quarter is purely driven by cutoff period of the day of the month, which some of the monies were not received yet, but no changes at all.
Thanks, Adrian. So Matt, hopefully that answers Miguel, hopefully that answers your question. Matt Dickinson is asking, are you planning to repay the Heathrow Finance PLC bond maturing in March 24, or will you refinance it in the capital markets? Did you cover that?
Yeah, we definitely will repay the Heathrow Finance bond maturing next year. And we don't do refinancing any particular bond, but another one, again, we're portfolio funding for Heathrow Finance as well. Just reminding everyone, we also have a £1 billion liquidity sitting at Heathrow Finance. So we will be and make sure we also maintain the liquidity horizon at Heathrow Finance.
Thank you. And Ryan Zeng, can you please elaborate on how you are managing your index link swaps and accretion pay downs? Have you communicated your strategy with the rating agencies?
Yes. So thanks, Ryan. I think as you know, I think if we step back, all our assets are RPI linked, and therefore it's just prudent to link a proportion of our debt to inflation. So we do that directly through bonds, but also through synthetically through swaps. So I think on average we have 50% of our debt linked to inflation. The way we manage that is I would say two things. First of all, is all the inflation accretion on our bonds, but also on our swaps, are within the definition of net indebtedness, and therefore every time we report our net debt is included within that. The second, which is a protection that is included in our financing documentation, is that we have a covenant that we cannot hold more than 8% of inflation related with our swaps when compared with our senior net debt. So we are comfortably operating within that headroom, and that's why every time that we are seeing inflation moving particularly fast over the last few months, we are proactively making early pay downs in the accretion to operate comfortably within that 8% covenant level. In terms of rating agencies, yes, we continue having a regular dialogue with credit rating agencies. They know very well our policies and plans. And again, one of the things that we have been operating with credit rating agencies as well as with creditors is no surprises. So hopefully no surprises on that front either.
Probably just still worth adding, Javier, all of our swaps, inflation swaps, interest rate swaps don't have any breaks, yeah. No matter whether it's either voluntary or mandatory breaks. There's no breaks in our swap portfolio.
Great, thank you. So another question from Sophie Aldrich, which I think we've answered, which is, could you discuss your financing plans and plans to address upcoming maturities? I think we've covered that. And then a great question from Krishi Shah. Hi, my name is Krishi. I'm an intern at BNP. Could you please share any tips for achieving a very successful career? Well, Krishi, I think you've just fulfilled my tip, which is always put your hand up. People like to work with people who volunteer and put themselves forward for things. And you've obviously had the confidence to put your hand up, even if just in the chat. But that's the best thing to do if you want to get yourself noticed, because people always need help and are glad to have talented people like you who are willing to lean in. Fab. So I think that completes questions on the line. I think we might have a follow-up question from James earlier, or has that been covered?
No, I think it hasn't been covered.
Great.
I think it's just the one
for okay, good. Well,
one second.
Thanks. Good. So do you have any questions in the room? And if so, we have a microphone. We'll need to get to you so that people on the line can hear. Brilliant. Well, that's a resounding silence. So
I'm afraid, John, that if there's no questions, I just want to say a word, considering this is your last results presentation. Obviously, John has been with us 10 years, 40 results presentation, for God's sake. And so I'm super grateful for having John as a mentor, as a boss, as a friend. One of the things you have heard is his two big passions are people. And you can see that some of us here, one is myself. I joined Heathrow 15 years ago as an enthusiastic down and finance manager. Today I'm still enthusiastic, less down, and CFO. And I think that is having a great boss who believes in you that allows that. I think the other thing is John and I have been learning together in terms of how to put in place the capital structure of Heathrow over the last so many years. And one of the things that probably he's not aware is that during his 10 years, he has completed £19 billion of financing with this credit community, which is an extraordinary success. But I think the important one is he has always been pushing us in terms of looking at next options. So obviously, one of those is our sustainability-linked bond. I think when John made the decision to stand down, we got in finance the internal goal to try to complete our SLB before he was standing down. And we did it. So thank you for credit community to allow that to happen. And to celebrate that, we have a tombstone for John. But obviously, being a sustainable link bond, a tombstone is in a very different shape. So
it's a tree.
Thank you, John,
fantastic.
For everything.
I'm very touched. I thought you were going to thank me by returning us to profit, but I'll leave Thomas to have that pleasure. But thank you all, and thanks for all your support.
Thank you,
very
touched. Thank you.
Thank you. This now concludes our presentation. Thank you all for attending. You may now disconnect.